previously on Popping Collars.
Doesn't he want to make a dinosaur game? Am I making that
Doesn't he always want to make a dinosaur game?
I don't know. We do have a dearth of dinosaur games, though.
We've got Goat Simulator now. That's a step in the right direction. It's a short hop, skip, and a jump from Goat Simulator to Brontosaurus Simulator.
Well, that's a fantasy game, though, because Brontosaurus never existed.
That's like the planet Pluto.
Yeah, Brontosauruses all live on the planet Pluto.
Welcome to Popping Collars,
the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture, the show where priests, pastors, ministers, and religious thinkers from around the country weigh in on what people are binge-watching, tweeting about, trolling on message boards, and celebrating on blogs. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida, and I am your host of this roundtable conversation with our guests, who this week include Martin Elford from Spokane, Washington. Hello, Martin.
Hi, Greg.
And Kyle Goodman from Statesville, North Carolina. Hello, Kyle.
Glad to be here again, Greg.
This is episode 14 of Popping Collars, and our topic today is the movies of Joel and Ethan Coen, known collectively as the Coen brothers. So going all the way back to Blood Simple, really, in 1984, up to Inside Llewyn Davis from just a few years ago, the Coens have balanced being critical darlings and also being fan favorites. Their work ranges from broad comedies like Raising Arizona and The Big Lebowski to suspenseful thrillers like No Country for Old Men and Fargo. So an easy question to get our discussion going: what Coen film stands out for you? And what is it about it that you connect with?
I'm not convinced you've asked an easy question at all, Greg.
No.
I think you're asking me to pick my favorite Beatles album or, you know, the best piece of music Mozart ever wrote. So I'm going to give a different answer to this every day of the week. The answer I'm going to give today is Miller's Crossing, probably because I saw that movie during the time in my life when I was just living in an art house cinema. One of my buddies and I in high school and then tracking into university were just at the Ridge Theater in Vancouver, British Columbia constantly. And I remember watching Miller's Crossing just with, you know, delight and wide eyes at the same time. The Coens were taking us into territory that I don't think I'd seen in the cinema previously. Somehow simultaneously absurd and beautiful. It's a remarkably well shot film. Barry Sonnenfeld, the guy who subsequently directed Men in Black, is the cinematographer for that. It's just such a beautiful film, filled with moral dilemmas and stuff that is, you know, you hear about that popular expression, from the sublime to the ridiculous. The Coens somehow managed to do sublime and ridiculous simultaneously. So think about, is it Albert Finney, the mobster boss? He's, you know, survives this hit and indeed responds with just this intense bloody violence and is heading down the street, Tommy gun in hand, while Danny Boy continues to play. You know, he started it on his gramophone, and even though his house is burning to the ground, like, no matter, it, you know, the song is just remains there as he heads down the street, just riddling everyone and everything with bullets. And I just have such fond memories and intense memories of seeing that.
Well, I do have a favorite, and I love so many of them, but my favorite is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That film, maybe more so than any others. I was rewatching the Big Lebowski last night, and I love that movie. But I felt like as I'm watching it, yeah, I know what's coming, and I've been there. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? I've seen that film 20 times now. And every time I watch it, I laugh hysterically, even though I know every single line that's coming. And every time I watch it, I end up wanting to talk to someone about the rich theological themes that are coming out of it. I end up wanting to talk about the metaphor of baptism. I end up wanting to talk about pride and hubris. I find myself wanting to talk about the journey that we make in life and the things that are truly important and ultimately important, the treasure that we seek. It's something different every time. And dare I say it, there are few things that I read or watch or experience that just continue to be that well again and again and again. The Bible is that for me. I'm not comparing, Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou, to the Bible, but it does have that same sort of richness. It's generative for me.
Often you've got a character, frequently or almost always a sympathetic character. I was thinking about this the last few days. Overwhelmingly films populated with sympathetic characters with whom, even if they're pathetic or eccentric, we can identify, and who are on this, almost biblical search for home or something like that, something that we can really identify with. And you may have mentioned the one that is sort of the most complete parable of all their films.
They do this great job of creating these characters that you sort of sympathize with, and you think to yourself, well, these are the worst possible people to be journeying through the wilderness because they seem the least prepared for what they're going to experience out there. And yet that's so us, right? I mean, we all sort of go through our wilderness journeys at some point in our life where we feel totally ill prepared for what's going to happen to us. And yet, we're seen through to the other side by the grace of God, hopefully. My character that I always think about when I think of sympathetic Coen characters is Norville from The Hudsucker Proxy, because he's just so sweet and so simple, and he has a really simple idea. He for kids, yes. it's this little circle that happens to be the hula hoop that is going to be this genius idea that kids are ultimately going to love, and yet he's caught up in this corporate system and this evil system of sort of a spiritual devil trying to make him into something that he's not. And he just maintains his simplicity and his decency throughout the entire story. And I want to think that that's kind of what the Coens are trying to say is, Norville just stayed true to himself, even when it meant that maybe he wouldn't climb the corporate ladder the way he wanted to. He would still be his authentic self.
Right. I know that character from a number of children's books. We could argue there's some of that in Raising Arizona. You've got a pair of protagonists who, even if they're making really stupid choices, are always kind of doing it from this good-hearted place.
I think that's right. The beauty of Raising Arizona is that these simple characters, and I would say that they are pretty simple characters, have one desire, which is just a family. They just want a family so bad. A family in this case being they want to have children. That's an important distinction to point out.
Yep.
It's not until they give up trying to make it happen that it sort of happens for them. Mm-hmm. But we don't see it happen. We just see it as a dream sequence at the end, that somehow they've fulfilled whatever it is that family means to them. They dream it into existence. Mm-hmm. And so that's a neat way to say that maybe they do have kids and maybe they don't, but somehow they've found fulfillment mm-hmm. by kind of giving up on that pursuit.
Yeah, the same way the dude gives up his rug or...
The rug did tie the room together.
It
though,
did.
To be fair.
or even Ulysses Everett McGill gives up on his absolute objection to anything to do with faith and superstition at the end. He has fought that you know, through and through, all the way to the end of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And finally, he just can't do anything but pray.
So that's a good place to go, I think, because there are a few places where the Coens, when we've mentioned this before, they put their protagonists in a situation where they have to deal with something chaotic. And sometimes that something chaotic is from nature, and sometimes it's another person. Sometimes it's just evil, you know, however evil kind of manifests itself. So spoilers here. We've talked about how Popping Colors is a spoiler zone. So if you haven't seen Coen Brothers movies, go watch them. Yeah, the ending of Our Brother, Where Art Thou? He hits his knees. George Clooney hits his knees, prays, and the three of them are delivered from this Marshall character, this devil Marshall character that's been hunting them down for the entire film. They're delivered by a flood that we know is going to happen. We were told at the beginning of the movie that this valley was going to be flooded. So it's not a miracle, really. And yet it happens at an opportune time that actually frees those characters that are being hunted down. So you juxtapose that scenario with the scene from A Serious Man, the ending of that movie, where, again, you have a character that makes a choice, that decides to show mercy to a student by changing his F grade to a C-minus grade. And he's kind of been manipulated to do that, but he does do it to kind of help this kid out. And then what immediately happens next is a tornado comes and threatens to rip through the town, and that's the end of the scene. So you have this one scene where it looks like, you know, a character prays and is delivered by God, and you ask yourself, well, was God in the flood to deliver them, and was their prayer answered? And then you have another example where a character shows mercy to another character, and now it looks like it's all awash in the end because everything's going to get destroyed by a tornado. And is God in the tornado? You know, I mean, it's this sort of question of, you know, how does deliverance work, and how does randomness work in the world?
Well, we began by talking about how the films are, you know, are parables, or sort of a modern take on a parable, and we do end in that very place where, you know, almost always there's some ambiguity. I mean, things are neatly resolved, and yet, you know, all of the Coen Brothers films. You know, you mentioned it with Raising Arizona, how it ends with, you know, a possibility. Is it or is it not? You know, even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which wraps up so neatly, you know, you still have him trying to win back his love. I mean, you know, the question is where do we go from here at the end? You know, how do we carry on after we've had this experience? And in that sense, it is very true to life. On the one hand, these are great stories, and yet they make us ask the question, you know, when the story's over, where do we go?
They're really interested, it seems to me, and maybe this is a different way of saying something you said earlier, Greg, in what everyday people look like under big stress. And they've typically introduced that stress by some kind of violence, in some cases quite extreme violence. I don't know if that's necessarily integral to their storytelling, or if they've just figured that's the most effective way of creating a crisis that is going to have a story flow out of it. Am I right in thinking that True Grit is the first time that they went back in time before the 20th century? It seems to me all of their films were set either in the present or in kind of at the earliest in the 30s prior to that. Those are two things I notice throughout their movies. I believe they're always in America, and up until True Grit, they'd always been in the 20th century or right now, as the case may be.
Yeah, and it's important to note that they won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for adapting The Odyssey of all things.
Right.
Who has to quote the Virginia state lawmaker from a few weeks ago, who has the chaputzvah? the chutzpah, right? To adapt The Odyssey. You know, the villains are just so great and so varied, and you can usually see, like, when they're doing a pure kind of evil devil figure. And they show up quite a bit. So, like, Barton Fink is probably the most on-the-nose, like, devil that they've done with Madman Muntz. Because, like, you know, flames come out of the walls and stuff. You know, it's fairly explicit there. But then you have characters like the biker from Raising Arizona, or Anton Chigurh, right, from No Country for Old Men, who are sinister and yet charismatic, a little compelling. They draw you in and then sort of crush your dreams, that kind of thing. And I've always really appreciated the way that they are nuanced with their evil characters.
We watched Raising Arizona at church recently and had a discussion afterwards that went in a marvelous and unexpected direction when someone said that Leonard Small, so the biker in Raising Arizona, is a Jungian shadow self. And I thought, oh, I hadn't expected Jung to come up in this discussion, but actually, yes. And actually, I think we could make the case that those devil figures are frequently shadow selves, that in a way, the, you know, the neighbor in Barton Fink, or even the devil who's hunting the trio in Oh Brother, are kind of the worst selves of our heroes. They are who those people are when they've succumbed to immorality or succumbed to temptation or what have you. And that's maybe most explicit in Raising Arizona. But in a way, the devil is something that George Clooney's character releases through his behavior. I mean, I suppose actually quite literally, because that devil is chasing him because they've escaped. But I think there's also a metaphorical or figurative level where he's let that character into the world. And it's as he pointed out, it's only through prayer at the end that he's able to drown him.
And that character is absolutely unyielding in the same way that George Clooney's character is unyielding in his, you know, insistence on reason and enlightenment, you know. And he gets to that place where the reasonable thing to do is to honor the law's pardon, you know. There it is for all to know and see. And yet, you know, he has been so unreasonable and so filled with his own hubris, you know, that's really the point where he comes to. This shadow self, as you said, just reflects that and his own willingness to yield his quest.
That first dream that High has of Leonard Smalls in Raising Arizona, when he's like driving out of the fire on the motorcycle and stuff, and he takes the grenade and blows up the bunny. Such a great scene. But High has that one line where he says he destroys innocent things. Like he preys on the innocent or something like that. Because that's kind of the definition for every one of their evil characters moving forward, was that they prey on innocence. And so that's obviously in the Hudsucker Proxy. Paul Newman's character preys on Norville and Norville's innocence. And that's how you know that he's the evil figure, the devil figure, because he's exploiting what he thinks is a weakness, but what's revealed in the end to be Norville's greatest strength, which is just simple decency in the face of greed and pride and power. I always think of Fargo, right, and Marge, and how she's surrounded by this evil and this darkness. And there's this moment at the end of that movie where she says, "And I suppose that was your partner in the wood chipper," like kind of matter of factly. And yet she's not going to be affected by it. She's not going to let it pull her down. Instead, she just says, "You know, I don't understand." And she looks out the car window and she says, "It's a beautiful day." Mm-hmm. So she can still see the beauty that's around. She's not going to give in to the darkness. And I think that that's so often where the evil in Coen films try to get the characters to go, is to give in to despair and to sort of their depression.
I wonder if this isn't one of the things that Paul is trying to get at when he calls faith foolishness, that there is for those folks who have decided that the world is just irreparably broken and the only way to function is for me to participate in that brokenness, faith is always going to look foolish. It's always going to look stupid. And so the character who says, I can see beauty anyway, is a kind of simpleton is certainly risking being seen as one. And in a way, there's something really powerful in someone who is able to say, yeah, I recognize you think I'm naive, and I'm going to delight in life anyway. I've been hanging out with Kent Hoffman the last little while. He is one of the architects of Circle of Security. So this really, really neat early childhood intervention program, their goal being teaching parents how to create really secure children, how to create a holding environment where a child can go out and take a risk and then come back, the parent, when he or she needs to, and know that he or she is going to find comfort. And so, you know, this is like 40 years of study that they've now done of kids, following them into adulthood and looking at kids who grow up to be capable of vulnerability and autonomy is what they're interested in. And something he said, well, so many of the things he said caught in my mind, but he said that the really secure child believes that good things happen after bad things, and that good things happen after good things. That there's this confidence that there is, they got the theological language, there's some confidence that there's going to be resurrection. And that's maybe you've named the character in Fargo who most embodies that. She's literally pregnant with new life. And mm-hmm. but also that just shines through who she is. I refuse to sink into the cynicism. I refuse to sink into the apathy. I refuse to sink into the selfishness that I see around me. Look, the world's beautiful.
And I like that idea of, you know, good things follow bad things, good things follow good things. Mm-hmm. Because the character where it seems like bad things follow bad things, or at least strange things follow strange things, is the dude. Like, mm-hmm. right. It seems like he's on this cycle. The minute he loses his rug, where it's just bad thing after bad thing after bad thing, and yet by the end of the film, he's able to sort of look back and say, you know, gutters and strikes, ups and downs, you know, that's how he kind of frames his world. Even though it looks like he's just had one bad thing after another, he sees it as all kind of a wash in the end. He's not necessarily affected, and that may sort of speak to who the dude is, but I think it also sort of shows a little bit of how his arc worked in that movie, that he was able to kind of let go of everything having to be perfect, of the rug having to pull the room together, the plans all working out exactly right, people knowing that he was one Lebowski and the other Lebowski was a different Lebowski. You know, he was able to let all of that go, and in the end, just, you know,
abide. That's a problem that Llewyn Davis has, is no matter where he goes or where he turns, he's, you know, he's got to be who he is in this prideful way. And it never works out for him. It's the, you know, same with Everett, and to some degree the same in Raising Arizona as well. We've got to have it our way, and it can't be any way, and we're going to do whatever we have to in order to, you know, have the world and be in control of the world as you know, we have to have it. That freedom of letting go and letting life happen, and, you know, making the most of what does happen to us. That thing comes up again and again and again, I think, in their films. And, you know, and how to abide. How do we make peace with our life as it is, and find joy and happiness in that?
It so feels like, what is it, those inspirational posters that you see in office boardrooms, right, of the cat hanging from the tree, and it's like, hold on. If there's a common theme, it's let go. Let go of all this stuff that you think is necessary in order to navigate life, all this control that you feel like you have to have. Let go of it.
Yeah,
because
consider the lilies.
Ultimately, yeah, you're gonna end up killing you. Consider the lilies.
Consider the birds of the air. Do they need a rug?
Because it's ultimately going to kill you if you keep trying to take control of everything. Mm. And boy, that's a tough lesson for us to hear sometimes.
Oh, it is.
And you pointed out that their movies are always American movies or set in America. Mm-hmm. Maybe that is something there, because there is this idea of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, be your own man,
right?
Like that kind of stuff. And take personal responsibility. And all of that is just putting pressure on yourself to control as much as you can. And at the end of the day, there's going to be things that you can't control, mm-hmm. and you're just going to have to let go. Mm-hmm. Let go.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that's in the end why they had to make a Western. I mean, that is the quintessential genre that says the loner on the horse can figure out how to navigate this world.
And what's the great scene from True Grit? It's when he lets go of the reins, he puts them in between his teeth, mm-hmm. he says, feel your hands, you son of a, you know, to Ned Pepper, and he lets go of the reins, and he just lets the horse take him, and he rides straight into the battle.
Yeah, speaking of letting go, just love the moment at the end of Man Who Wasn't There when the door of the death house is open and he goes out to have a moment with the flying saucer. I mean, so ridiculous, and it's so beautiful at the same time. Like, I know that moment. Not that I've had a communion with a space alien, but I know what the moment is when you're like, okay, this is not what I would have chosen, and somehow it's okay.
You know, we've talked around the idea that that all of the Coen brothers' main characters are people that, even in their ridiculousness, we can relate to. And I think that we relate to them because even though they are characters written for a story, there's something about all of them that is authentic, that seems real to us, even if the circumstances they're in are totally not real. There's that identifier. And I was thinking how important it is in our faith communities to not come in and play a part, but,
yep.
but to be authentic and real. And what's attractive about that? So often, I think, as clergy, we're expected to play a part.
Yep.
And the people who sit in our churches for services and activities play the part of good church person who mm-hmm. doesn't have a struggle, doesn't have a problem or a care in the world because they serve a good God who is in control of everything. And so life is perfectly put together and ordered. And we all know what a complete and total falsehood that is. I think these characters resonate because they're characters that are authentic and sort of teach us how to be our authentic selves no matter what we're going through. We may not be tracking down homicidal killers and wood chippers or, you know, kidnapping a baby or trying to escape the long arm of the law. But, you know, in whatever struggles we face, to be who we are, authentic. And Greg was talking about this in terms of, you know, not being able to be in control of the circumstance, but, mm-hmm. you know, just to admit that we all are fallible, you know, that we have faults and, you know, and we have shortcomings and, you know, how important is it that we be real and authentic in who we are in our community of faith?
Oh, it's such a huge thing that the church at its best can offer to our wider culture. Cynicism is available by the truckload.
Mm-hmm.
You know, apathy is available by the truckload. What we call irony, but which yeah. is really this sort of habit of behaving like everything's a joke, is available by the truckload. I think church at its best offers something incredibly important when we say, what if this is a context where we actually talk about the truth? And we actually engage with the truth.
I've been sleeping with the lights on, buried in regrets, breaking into sweats, naked as a falling leaf. Well, it's a natural reaction, driven to distraction, clawing at the ghost I'll never meet. Oh, and I don't know where they go when they vanish in the corners of my eyes. And I don't know why, I don't know if they stay below or rise up to the sky. But I'm letting go, I'm letting go. close, I'm letting go. I'm a slave without a master, heading for disaster, kicking up the dust.
We go ahead and do our Go in Pieces segment, where we get to pitch our Twitter feeds, our church websites, our contact information, however it is that people can get in touch with us and however it is that we can get in touch with people. So, Kyle, where are you? What are you doing? How can people find you?
Well, I am pastor of Concord Presbyterian Church in Statesville, North Carolina. You can find the church on the web at concordpreschurch.com. We also have a Facebook page, and you can find me on Facebook, too. I'd love to be your friend.
We all need more friends.
We do.
Martin, who are you? Where are you? How can people get in touch with you?
I'm a priest at the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist in Spokane, Washington. As you pointed out last time, almost your perfect geographic opposite.
It is, almost exactly.
In continental United States. You can find St. John's Cathedral pretty readily on Google. It'll send you right here. I write an advice column on a wonderful website called Spokane Faith and Values. Surf over there and look for Father Knows Best. And I've only recently learned the difference between tweeting and twerking, but I do tweet from time to time at Martin Elfert, Elfert being spelled E-L-F-E-R-T.
And my name is Greg Knight. You can find me as the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at the Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida, the geographical opposite of Spokane, Washington, with all of the weather that that entails. We are on the web at bbts.org. Popping Collars is on Facebook, where you can like us and friend us. I thought about taking down the opportunity to friend us, but you're right, Kyle. We need friends in this world. Like, what are we without our friends? Jesus had friends, and so does Popping Collars. So you can like us or friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can email us, poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram now. We're at Popping Collars Podcast. For the podcast, you can find us at the usual suspects. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn. You can subscribe to our podcast and feel free to review our shows and rate us at iTunes. You can also go to our website, poppingcollarspodcast.com. We are featured each episode on EpiscopalCafe.com, which is a wonderful website, and we appreciate them hosting us and hope that you will check it out. So that's Popping Collars for this week. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Martin, for being with us. And keep those collars popped. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.